Gaza as Israel keeps pounding the besieged strip incessantly. The regime's fresh air raids killed over 100 Palestinians across the Gaza Strip. 15 of them lost their lives in Khan Yunis, south of the blockaded territory. The war on Gaza is now in its 21st day. The total death toll has crossed 7,300. At least 70% of those killed are women and children. The humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate as well. That's because Israel has laid a total siege on Gaza, cutting off water, electricity, food, fuel, and medicine to the territory. And for 3 weeks, Palestinians in Gaza have been witnessing heartbreaking scenes of devastation and death caused by Israel's constant air attacks. Every day and even every hour, they pull out dead bodies from under the rubble, laying to rest women and children. The residents in the besieged strip are angry over the world's silence and inaction.
It's like the nuclear bombings of Hiroshima. There's no humanity left in the world. No one is standing by us. We haven't slept since yesterday and we haven't been able to pull anyone out from under the rubble. In this house, there were 70 to 80 people. Young children still remain under the rubble. What have these children done? Did they kill Israelis? They didn't kill anyone. They were just sitting safe in their homes and the whole residential block was brought down.
All those who lived here were innocent civilians. The airstrikes targeted our homes while we were inside them. Thank God we were able to emerge from under the rubble. God saved us, but there are no homes left, nothing here.
The UN Relief and Works Agency has warned about the deteriorating humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip.
Basic services are crumbling. Medicine is running out. Food and water are running out. The streets of Gaza have started overflowing with sewage. Gaza is on the brink of a massive health hazard as the risk of diseases are looming. What is needed is meaningful and uninterrupted aid flow. And to succeed, we need an humanitarian ceasefire to ensure this aid reaches those in need.
Lazzarini said the strikes are killing people, but many people are also dying as a result of Israel's total blockade. He said basic services in the Palestinian territory are crumbling. The UNRWA chief said there have been intense negotiations and endless diplomacy to open a humanitarian supply line, but it has only resulted in a handful of aid convoys. He said Gaza is being strangled and Palestinians there feel shunned, alienated, and abandoned. The comments come as people in the besieged territory are facing acute shortages of food, medicine, water, and basic necessities. Doctors say they are only able to accept critical cases as hospital and intensive care unit beds are filled up with the war victims.
Medicine is running out. Food and water are running out.
We were forced to release all our previous patients during the war, and now we are only admitting injured people who need surgeries. There are no more beds for incoming injured.
We have been experiencing a severe shortage of capabilities in all departments and hospitals since before this war began, and medical equipment and supplies are in short supply at the Ministry of Health. However, days after this aggression, our stock is barely sufficient to meet the necessities of these patients, putting their lives at risk. The lack of fuel poses another critical threat to the lives of hundreds of patients in care departments, as it negatively affects the uninterruptible electricity, and we are forced to minimize the mechanical ventilators in the unit.
With all hospitals running out of fuel to power their generators, doctors have warned that critical equipment like incubators for newborns risks stopping. The World Health Organization says a third of Gaza hospitals are not operating. Doctors Without Borders has warned that at Gaza City's Al Shifa Hospital, the lack of medicine and clean water has led to alarming infection rates. It says amputations are often required to prevent infection from spreading in the wounded. The military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has once again targeted Tel Aviv with barrages of rocket fire in response to what it called the massacre of civilians in Gaza. Six Israelis have been reportedly injured in the operation by the Qassam Brigades, a resistance movement's rockets also hit the southern city of Ashkelon. the regime's Re'im military base near the Gaza Strip also came under attack. Several Israeli cities, including Ashdod and Sderot, have been targeted by the resistance group while the Israelis continue to bombard the Gaza Strip. Over 1,400 Israelis have been killed since Palestinian resistance fighters launched Operation Al-Aqsa Flood on October the 7th in response to decades of Israeli crimes and occupation. Thousands more Israelis have also been wounded, while over 200, including the regime's soldiers, have been taken captive. People across the world continue to stage rallies in support of Palestinians. Thousands of angry demonstrators took to the streets in Jordan's capital to condemn the Israeli atrocities in Gaza and call for the dismissal of the Israeli ambassador to Amman. Elsewhere in Yemen's Sana'a, protesters denounced Israel's genocidal war against Palestinians. Egyptians also gathered in the Al Azhar Mosque to voice their support for Palestinians. Iraqis took to the streets of the capital Baghdad for the same reason. Palestinians in several parts in the occupied West Bank, including Ramallah, Al-Khalil, Nablus, and Tulkarm, also rallied in solidarity with the people of Gaza. Similar rallies were held in several other countries on Thursday, including the U.S., India, Belgium, and Spain. Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires, too, saw thousands of people marching on the Israeli embassy to denounce the regime's brutality. Pro-Palestine ralliers in central Moscow, they shared their views on Israel's ongoing brutal onslaught against Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip. Let's take a listen.
We are here to declare our solidarity with Palestine and the Palestinian people. This means that the truth is behind us and is above everything, and what is built on lies will ultimately be lost. Palestine is for Muslims, and everything that Israel does is a lie and is built on lies. In the end, by the will of Allah, victory will be ours. We want to congratulate the Palestinian resistance for the victory they are achieving every day.
We came to the capital of Russia, Moscow, from Lebanon to say words of support to our people of Palestine and Gaza. We grew up in this conflict and will not leave it if we die one after another. From the first day of our birth, we are raised by our parents in such a way that the Palestinian conflict is common to all Lebanese, Muslims, and people of all faiths. We will defend to the death. We will liberate Palestine. We will pray at Al-Quds. We want to tell the whole world that if the Arab leaders are silent, we will not be silent. We breathe freedom, and no one can block this air for us.
We protest against the genocide committed by the Israeli occupiers in Palestine in general and in the Gaza Strip in particular. As Palestinians abroad, we still believe this is the end of Israel. What happened on October 7th is direct evidence of Israel's shame and disgrace. It is obvious that they cannot resist the Palestinian people. Israel's furious revenge in the form of bombs and missiles on our land and peaceful people is the revenge of despair. We cannot stop at written and verbal condemnations of the Israeli genocide. How many more Palestinian children must die for the whole world to come to their defense? Does this mean that what is happening in Ukraine is a war according to international rules and the direct extermination of Palestinians is the defense of Israel?
Despite the cold and rainy weather, we joined a stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people in central Moscow. Participants raised the flags of Palestine, Russia, and Hezbollah. Banners and slogans are raised through which the participants express their anger at the massacres taking place against the people of Gaza. We demand an immediate cessation of the barbaric aggression and the prosecution of the leaders of the Zionist enemy for the crimes committed in Palestine. The participants denounce the American and international position that is biased towards the Zionist enemy and the direct partner in the massacres.
The mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, has broken ranks with his party's leadership to call first ceasefire in Gaza. He made the call during a video posted on social media.
The terrible situation in Gaza now looks set to deteriorate even further. Thousands of innocent civilians, men, women, and children have already been killed, and it's becoming impossible for aid to reach the people who desperately need it. Substantial military escalation is now likely, which will only deepen the humanitarian disaster. I joined the international community in calling for a ceasefire. It would stop the killing and would allow vital aid supplies to reach those who need it in Gaza. It would also allow the international community more time to prevent a protracted conflict in the region and further devastating loss of life.
Khan warned that a widespread Israeli military escalation will only deepen the humanitarian disaster, adding that the regime does not have the right to break international law. The Scottish Labour leader, as well as hundreds of the party's councillors and nearly a quarter of MPs, have also called for an immediate cessation of violence. This mounts pressure on Labour leader Keir Starmer. He and the ruling Conservative Party leader Rishi Sunak have so far resisted calling for a total ceasefire. Starmer is also facing criticism by many voters across the country since appearing to give his support to Israel of cutting off water, fuel, energy, and food supplies to Gaza. Israel has intensified its crackdown in the Occupy while also pressing ahead with its bombardments of the Gaza Strip in Jenin. Palestinians have held a funeral for two of the latest victims of the regime's atrocities. Israeli troops raided the towns of Galgilia and Jenin earlier today, killing four Palestinians, including a newly freed prisoner. Regime forces also arrested dozens of people there and elsewhere across the West Bank. Tensions are simmering in the occupied territories, with Palestinians outraged over the Israeli massacre of people in Gaza. At least 110 people have been killed during Israeli raids in the West Bank since the Gaza war began. And the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has hit at least six military targets in Israeli-occupied territories. Hezbollah said it struck the targets, including Miskav Am Kibbutz, with precision-guided missiles. The group said sites in Kfar Shuba and Shabwa Farms region were also hit. The statement added some technical capabilities of the Israeli facilities were destroyed. This came after Israel carried out attacks on southern Lebanon. The area has witnessed exchanges of fire since the 8th of October, a day after a major Palestinian operation against Israel. There have been several casualties and deaths on both sides. Well, for more insight, we're now joined by writer and political columnist Saeed Shahabi, who's with us from the British capital, London. Mr. Shahabi, 21 days of indiscriminate bombing on the besieged Gaza Strip. We've seen the scope of death and destruction. Residential buildings and infrastructure have totally been obliterated, and yet the likes of the United Nations and its Security Council have not managed to implement a ceasefire to stop the suffering of the Gazans. Why is that?
Thank you very much. This is a shameful stand by the international community. It is very simple. You have war. You have a destructive war that has been raging for 21 days. As many put this question, how many more Palestinians must be killed before this international community wakes up and says, oh, enough is enough? I don't understand how a decent politician will resist a call to stop fighting. Anywhere, if there is any conflict anywhere, you must always stop that conflict. Okay, you may call for the conflict to end, but the combatants may not end it, but at least you have said what you should say, that stop fighting, stop arguing, stop making problems among yourselves. These are common sense. Now, for some politicians to refrain from saying that word, ceasefire, is really, really problematic, because you cannot have in this day and age people who condone war, especially when you see the destruction at such a high rate as we see, a total destruction, obliteration of neighborhoods, obliteration of towns, of cities, bringing down towers of flats, killing 400, 500, 600 people every day. And then you are, it is, you think it is too much for you to say, stop fighting, stop the war. Is that too much to stop 600 people being killed in 24 hours? If that is too much, so who are you? Who do you belong to? Which race? Do you belong to humanity, to the human race? Or do you have no heart? You have no feeling? No, you must know that each child has a family. Of course, in certain cases, the whole families have been obliterated, have been killed. And yet, you find it too much to say, stop the war, ceasefire, observe a ceasefire. So I don't know why. It just shows me that they are bowing to the pressures from the West, from America, which wants to see it more going on. However, in my opinion, the war has been finalized. Israel is not going to win. It's as simple as that. If after 21 days of continuous bombardment and they are still bombing more and more and killing more and more, it means that they have lost the initiative. Within 4 or 5 days of such bombardment, they should have declared victory and ended it. But it seems to me that it is not going their way.
All right, thanks a lot. Writer and political columnist Saeed Shahabi from the British capital, London. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The House of Representatives has been left rudderless for weeks after Kevin McCarthy was ousted from the top spot and three nominees to replace him dropped out of the running. However, Republicans have now nominated Representative Mike Johnson of Louisiana to be House Speaker. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Representative Mike Johnson won the GOP nomination for House Speaker on Tuesday night, 24th of October, defeating Representative Byron Donalds and becoming the fourth Speaker designate selected by his party since Representative Kevin McCarthy's historic removal as Speaker and the second in a single day. The third nominee, Majority Whip Tom Emmer, dropped out of the Republican race for Speaker just 4 hours after he was elected on Tuesday. He failed to persuade far-right members of the conference to support him on the floor. Over 20 opposed him during a roll call vote, and former President Donald Trump expressed strong opposition to Tom Emmer shortly after he won the nomination, posting on Truth Social, "Voting for a globalist rhino, Republican in name only like Tom Emmer, would be a tragic mistake. Donald Trump said Emma was out of touch with Republican voters. Asked on Tuesday evening, 24th of October, by reporters whether Trump's opposition had been a deciding factor in his withdrawal from the speaker race, Tom Emmer replied, "I made my decision based on my relationship with the conference." There was a potential sign of trouble for Mike Johnson. Kevin McCarthy, who was not a declared candidate, received 43 votes in the final round of voting, well more than the 29 votes won by Representative Byron Donalds, who was official finalist in the race. After a Republican conference meeting ended, Mike Johnson spoke briefly to reporters and said that his intention is to go to the House floor on Wednesday, 25th of October, for a noon vote. He did not disclose the tally of the roll call vote in the conference to gate support for his nomination, but said he was very confident he could win the 217 GOP votes he needs to win the Speaker's gavel. Earlier, on Tuesday night, Ohio Representative Max Miller suggested there was growing support for restoring McCarthy to the speakership. "I actually think that we may be on a merry-go-round," Miller told reporters. "Who knows, we might end up back at Speaker McCarthy. He's still got the most votes on anybody in that room." Mike Johnson, who was first elected to Congress in 2016, voted against certifying the 2020 presidential election results. The House has now been without an elected speaker for 3 weeks, which means that it has not been able to consider or pass legislation to address a rising number of domestic and foreign crises. Representative Mike Johnson won on the final ballot for GOP Speaker, defeating Representative Byron Donalds, according to a tweet by Ellie Stefanik. Johnson won 128 votes and Donalds received 29 votes. Kevin McCarthy, who was not a nominee, received 43 votes, and there was one other vote of present. Johnson, a former radio host from Louisiana, was first elected to Congress in 2016. He voted against certifying the 2020 presidential election results. The national broadcaster NBC News has also covered this story. Republicans on Tuesday evening, 24th of October, nominated Representative Mike Johnson of Louisiana to be House Speaker. Johnson won the nomination just hours after previous nominee Tom Emmer of Minnesota dropped out when it became clear he could not secure the 217 votes needed to win the gavel in a House floor vote. Tom Emmer had defeated Mike Johnson and several other candidates earlier in the day. A nominee must secure 217 votes on the House floor to be elected, which has proven difficult. There are just 221 Republicans in the House, and conservative and moderate factions have been divided over who should be the leader after Kevin McCarthy was ousted. The House is scheduled to reconvene at noon on Wednesday, 25th of October. Johnson said he intends to seek a floor vote. Johnson told reporters that there were no votes against him in the roll call vote. That's meant to measure the support for a possible House floor vote. He did acknowledge, however, that there were some absences. He said he would work with those lawmakers who were absent. After he won the GOP nomination for the Speaker's gavel, Johnson told reporters that his intention is to go to the House floor at noon on Wednesday, 25th of October, to make this official. He needs 217 votes to win. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. House Republicans nominated Representative Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, for Speaker on Tuesday evening, 24th of October, making him the fourth GOP lawmaker to win the conference's nod, and its second nominee within a day after House Majority Whip Tom Emmer dropped out of the running amid GOP opposition. Mike Johnson's nomination capped off a whirlwind day, but one that ended with House Republicans appearing to finally unite around the Speaker nominee. In an internal roll call validation vote for Johnson, all but three GOP members who voted present said they could vote for Johnson for Speaker on the House floor, while at least a dozen members were absent, putting him under the 217-vote threshold in the room. Johnson signalled optimism that he would win their support. Democracy is messy sometimes, Mike Johnson, flanked by smiling GOP colleagues, said after the vote, this House Republican majority is united. The intention, Johnson said, is to go to the House floor on Wednesday, 25th of October. This is a servant leadership. We're going to serve the people of this country. We're going to restore their faith in Congress, this institution of government. And he said, the scene marked a stunning shift in attitude for House Republicans who had been stuck in something of a doom loop in the 3 weeks since eight of their colleagues joined with Democrats to oust the former Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Representative Matt Gaetz of Florida, who spearheaded the move to oust Kevin McCarthy, said of Mike Johnson's nomination, it was worth it. We adore him and I think he's going to do a great job for the country and for the right reasons. Mike Johnson has not bought and paid for. Mike Johnson does what is right, Matt Gaetz said. Johnson, 51 years old, has been the House GOP vice chairman, a junior leadership position, since 2021. He's also a former chairman of the Republican Study Committee, the largest conservative caucus in the House. Before joining Congress in 2017, Mike Johnson was a member of the Louisiana State House and Attorney, who had stints as a talk show host and a college professor. Now he's the GOP conference's fourth attempt to move past the three-week stalemate in the House.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, we offer our condolences to all Muslim brothers and sisters on the demise anniversary of Lady Fatima Masuma, peace be upon her, the daughter of Imam Musa Kazim, alayhi salam. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Dr. Shomali. He's going to talk about the character of Lady Masuma alayha salam.
We should know that Lady Masuma is not just a daughter of Imam, because Imams had many children. Prophets, messengers had many children, but not all of them are very special. Her name was Fatima. You know, if someone is called something as a name, it's important, but there is no guarantee. For example, maybe we call someone, for example, I don't know, I don't want to use any name, but doesn't mean that that person necessarily has that quality. Yeah, so maybe they call a person, I don't know, Kazim, Baqir, Sadiq, but maybe they don't have these qualities. It's a hope. With hope, they give them these names. But if someone is given a title, then that's different. For example, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam was given the title of Amin, Sadiqul Amin, by people of Mecca. It's very important because they saw in him these qualities so obviously that they called him As-Sadiq al-Amin. Now imagine if Imam, who is Ma'soom, gives someone a title. When he's referring to Lady Ma'soomah, instead of saying Fatima, says Ma'soomah. So it means that this lady is immaculate. This lady is very special. Yeah, it's very important. Man zara al-ma'sumata biqum kaman zarani. Also, there is another hadith, and I have quoted this few pages later. For example, a person is called Sa'd al-Ghummi. Sa'd from Qum met Imam Raza alayhi salam. Imam told him, is there any grave from us with you? And he said, yes, the grave of Fatima bint Musa is with us. Imam Raza said, na'am. من زارها عارفا بحقها فله الجنة. Whoever visits her while knows her right, go to heaven. My understanding is this. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has a plan for humanity. Part of that plan is to provide people who are truth-seeking with knowledge, proper knowledge. For that knowledge to spread all over the world, we need a hub of learning, which should have authentic teachings of Ahlul Bayt, but they should also be able to communicate. In order to have a hub of knowledge, we need a place that many people go and study and settle and teach and write and do research. This cannot happen with money. Many places, maybe people spend money, doesn't, you know, become special. This would not happen, for example, with having a great climate, you know, a very beautiful, you know, forest or, you know, coast, you know. No, we need a place that has a spirituality, a place that people would feel at home, and there are not too many distractions. There is a very important story in the time of late Ayatollah al-Uzma Burujerdi, the previous, you know, regime in the time of Ayatollah Burujerdi. At one point, they found some oil in Qom. Outside Qom, some wells reached oil. And many foreigners went to invest to, I don't know, work as technicians, etc. And ulama people were very worried that if Qom becomes an industrial city, then Hawza will be affected, you know. Now you go to Qom, Hawza and Sharai are central parts of the city. But imagine if it was a place that from all over the world people go for finding oil, you know, buying oil, selling, etc. So some ulama said to Ayatollah Burujerdi, ask the king to stop this. Although the king, you know, didn't have a very good relation with him, but had to respect Ayatollah Burujerdi, and, you know, there are stories about this. So Ayatollah Burujerdi said, this is not going to happen. Ayatollah Burujerdi was very great in understanding hadith and narrators of hadith. He said, this is not what I understand from our hadith. Qom is not going to become like that. And then, alhamdulillah, soon they said, it's not economical to work on these, you know, wells of oil. So they left the project. So we need a place which is not very busy. There are not too many distractions. People don't go there for, you know, you know, enjoying themselves, you know, near the beach or etc. Of course, I'm not against such things, but I'm saying we need a place that people go with a certain purpose, not, you know, people who go for other purposes. And, you know, in that time, you know, people, if they were going to the beach, you know, not necessarily observing hijab, etc. So For this purpose, Allah has chosen this city, city of Qom. And from beginning of Islam, generations of scholars and narrators of hadith, lovers of Ahlul Bayt were there. And then it was not by chance that Imam Reza went to Marv, and on his way he actually passed Qom, and he stayed in a place that later became Madrasa Razaviyya. And then Lady Ma'soom asked to be moved to Qom. And then we have a shrine that attracts people, gives them connection to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Sometimes we had our Christian friends, brothers and sisters, you know, in the shrine of Qom Mashhad, and they were crying, they were moved. They feel the spirituality of these places. And also what was very interesting for me, that Allah for this purpose has chosen a lady. Because, for example, it could be a city that one of the imams is buried. But in my, you know, humble opinion, I thought, if you want to attract people from all over the world, people who don't speak this language, people who may not, you know anything about this culture or place, etc., you need more a motherly figure than a fatherly figure. So Lady Ma'soom can host like a mother all these seekers of knowledge, all these seekers of, you know, light and spirituality. The type of love, the type of care that a mother gives is very special. And these people who go there, they need this love. They need to feel at home. So it's all connected that Qom has such function. Imam Sadiq says, Qom is our haram. From Qom, knowledge will be going all over the world to the extent that la yabqa mustad'afun fiddin. Imam Reza says, visiting her is like visiting me, encouraging people. Imam Jawad says. So this all is connected. So the plan of Allah and the understanding of Ahlul Bayt of the plan of Allah was to encourage people to consider this place as a special place of spirituality, a special place for the lovers of Ahlul Bayt, السلام, a place that could host Shiite seminaries, Shiite houses, Shiite places of learning. And this, inshallah, maybe there are ups and downs in the history. I'm not saying this always going to boom, you know, but it, despite ups and downs, we know that this is the line, that inshallah, up to the time of coming of Imam Mahdi, ajallallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, this place will remain always important.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
صلى Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A survey by the homelessness charity Shelter found that 40% of people in rented homes had experienced poor health as a result of their living conditions in the last year, amounting to almost 3 million people in England. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to a study, the social fabric of the United Kingdom's biggest cities is being transformed by sky-high rents and cuts to housing benefits as thousands of low-income private renters are pushed out of central areas, accelerating the suburbanisation of poverty. The new study found a trend driven also by the gentrification of once largely working-class neighbourhoods and the sell-off of social homes is excluding poorer people from inner cities and deepening divisions between rich and poor. It says low-income private renters, who a decade ago might have lived in city centres, are increasingly being displaced to a shrinking pool of affordable homes under urban periphery and beyond, often with poorer access to public transport, jobs and public services. The new study by the University of Glasgow found one in nine private renters in the UK's 10 biggest cities were displaced from central locations to cheaper housing areas in the suburban fringes during the eight-year period to 2020. For example, in Bristol, the number of low-income households living in privately rented homes in the inner city fell by 38% during the period. Glasgow saw a reduction of just over 20%, while London, Sheffield and Liverpool all saw reductions of more than 10%. The findings illustrate political and economic policy shifts over the past two decades that are changing traditional perceptions of inner-city areas as the main locus of poverty and deprivation, and the suburbs as exclusively more affluent places. The phenomena, known in academic circles as the suburbanisation of poverty, especially visible in countries such as Britain, Canada and the United States, where private rented housing has been deregulated and social security has been whittled away. Professor Nick Bailey, a co-author of the new study, said, "Continuing cuts in housing benefit levels, combined with the rising costs of inner-city renting, are engineering a fundamental change in the social fabric of British cities." Professor Nick Bailey added, "We need to examine the impacts this has on the welfare of poorer households as they are pushed to locations which tend to have worse public transport and worse access to jobs and vital services. But we also need to be asking whether this is the kind of city that we wish to create, one marked by deepening spatial divisions between rich and poor." The phenomena in part reflects the growing privately rented housing in the United Kingdom over the past three decades. While 1 in 10 households lived in this tenure in 1991, it now houses 1 in 5 households, including many families. More than 1 in 3 children in poverty live in privately rented homes. According to the new study by Glasgow University, a decade ago, roughly 20% of UK privately rented homes were affordable for households in receipt of housing benefit. This fell to 9% by 2020. Housing benefit rates have been frozen since then, making inner cities where private rents have risen fastest even less accessible to poorer people. Joseph Elliott of the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, a poverty charity, said, "It's clear that in large cities in particular, the diminished role of the state in providing social housing and cuts to support through housing benefit have resulted in people in poverty being priced out of areas with access to the amenities that we all need, such as easy access to work, shops and transport." Paul Sweeney, the Director of Policy and Research at the Centre for Cities think tank, said policymakers must consider the potential economic impact of the displacement of increasing numbers of low-income workers away from the city centre jobs in sectors such as hospitality and public services. A British government spokesperson claimed, "We're helping to ease the pressure of rising rents and investing over £30 billion on housing support this year, on top of record financial support worth around £3,300 per household. We've also maintained our £1 billion boost to local housing allowance, while our discretionary housing payments provide a safety net for anyone struggling." Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. Research suggested millions of British people living in damp and run-down properties are suffering worsening mental and physical health due to delays passing crucial reforms into law. A survey by the homelessness charity Shelter found about 40% of people in rented homes had experienced poor health as a result of their living conditions in the last year, amounting to almost 3 million people in England. Nearly two-thirds of renters in large swathes of the country, about 4.4 million people, said their mental health had worsened due to the housing worries since 2022. Campaigners are growing increasingly concerned that legal protections for renters, which are passing through Parliament, are being delayed due to opposition from Conservative MPs, of whom one in five are landlords. Osama Buta, director of campaigns at Shelter, said, "It is disgraceful that England's 11 million private tenants are at the mercy of a broken rental system while politicians sit on their hands and dither over whether to make renting fairer and safer." One of the main protections in the renters' bill is a ban on so-called no-fault evictions, known as Section 21 orders, whereby landlords can remove tenants without having to give a reason. Campaigners say Section 21 orders are one of the biggest causes of homelessness and are used by unscrupulous landlords to punish tenants who request basic repairs. The Conservatives first promised to ban Section 21 evictions in April of 2019, but did not introduce legislation until May of 2023. The bill had been expected to have a second reading in the House of Commons in the spring, but this is not expected to happen until November, amid reports of growing opposition to the reforms among Tory MPs. While the changes appear deadlocked in Westminster, official figures show that court proceedings for no-fault evictions have reached their highest level in the past 6 years. Research suggests someone is handed a no-fault eviction every 3 minutes, the equivalent of 543 a day, and almost 595,000 since 2020. A survey of more than 4,000 people in private rented accommodation in England suggests that delays to the changes were causing increasing ill health among those who fear eviction. According to the YouGov research on behalf of Shelter, more than 700,000 renters in London, almost 40% of the total, are suffering mental or physical problems due to worry of being evicted. People with disabilities are affected disproportionately by deteriorating health, with half of all disabled renters saying they had become more ill due to worrying about their living conditions, compared with 29% in the rest of the renting population.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this program, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a part of a speech delivered by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the veterans from the Sacred Defense and the Resistance Field. This meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 20, 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. Most of you have probably heard the story about Malik al-Ashtar. Malik al-Ashtar was a brave, strong commander in Imam Ali's army. He was a strong arm for the commander of the faithful. This is who Malik al-Ashtar was. He was walking in Kufa. This story apparently took place in Kufa when a young boy who didn't recognize him saw him and started to ridicule him. Maybe his clothes or his turban were in a way that seemed funny to the boy. The boy ridiculed him and laughed. Malik al-Ashtar didn't say anything and left. After he had passed by and left, someone asked the boy if he knew who he had just ridiculed. The boy said no. He told the boy that was Malik al-Ashtar. The boy became frightened and said, Now that I have treated Malik al-Ashtar in such a way, what will he do to me or my family? What should I do? The man said, Go apologize to him.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The boy went looking for him and find him and to apologize. He saw Malik al-Ashtar go into the mosque and become busy with praying. The boy waited for his prayer to finish. Then the boy went up to him and said, "Sir, I am sorry. I didn't recognize you. I was rude to you. Please forgive me." Malik al-Ashtar said, "I came to this mosque and performed two rak'ah prayers to pray for you." After all, a young person who acts in such a rude way requires prayers, and we should pray for him. He said, "I came here to pray for you." See, this is the type of man that Malik al-Ashtar was. The higher your military rank and power, the humbler and more compassionate you should be. Having authority is not in conflict with being polite. Authority is not in conflict with kindness. You heard how this gentleman spoke about a young man who took part in a sedition. He then went to prison, was pardoned, and came out of prison. Rahiyan-e-Noor, which is religious caravans that travel to the former battlefields of the Iran-Iraq war to narrate the events of that time for the younger generation, started their trips and he joined a group. Not for the sake of seeing the battlefields, but to go sightseeing. He decided he would just go to walk around. When he went there, the narrator, describing the events of the sacred defense, spoke of a few words and the young man started crying and sobbing loudly. He cried saying, "That what I did in the sedition was dishonorable.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me. Through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me. Through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I wanna thank you for bringing me home."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious